Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
discovery of the world's smallest molecule, helium-2 plus C2πu state. It's an excited state, but it's a molecule nonetheless. It's a metastable molecule. It doesn't last very long. It's up there. It's a molecule. It's the smallest molecule. And I'm going to talk through my discovery of it. And I sort of tend to shy away from reporting or communicating my personal research, because you tend to, even though this is well published in PhysRev A on a series of papers, and it's published, it's out there, I should be able to speak about it, but you have a tendency for as a representative of science, you don't refer to your own work, you refer to other people's work and present it as supported. You represent people's work and the quality associated with a person's work. It's a bit dubious to ever present your own work in an informal audience because they can't really trust the quality of it. I know that's a strange thing to say. So in general, I haven't really ever talked to people very much about my discovery of the world's smallest molecule. And I'm only doing this because it really explains my personal story from the world of classical physics, point physics, into across the chasm into an understanding of quantum mechanics, which over the years sort of mellowed, and as I've seen it in different aspects, it's improved. It's that first leap to come across, and there's sort of many threads to it. I suppose it's this sort of calmness and accepting that you've understood something, you've followed your instinct, you've researched it, and you've published it, but there's no acknowledgement, there's no social support for it, there's no job at the end of it, and all that type of stuff. There's no fantasy tale which is offered, and for some people that would be a big thing, but I suppose I've got to reveal some basic things. So and this is one of the things, beautiful parallel. So when I was a small kid, I didn't speak until I was probably I did speak, but incomprehensibly. And for about 8 years, until I was 8 years old, 0 to 8, I didn't speak comprehensibly. So much so, I had people at school, the kids would understand me, the teachers wouldn't, and they'd say, "Well, what did he say?" And I had one or two people who would translate to me. And then I just had to really slug and work and learn to speak. I had to actually teach myself to speak. Of course, this has happened. This is sort of like an echo of my childhood in terms of, like, I know what to do. If I can't speak, I've got to really slog myself and train myself to speak. So I'm really sort of reenacting my childhood again. This is pretty amazing. I didn't think of that. That's why I instinctively knew that if I had a problem, that all I had to do is just practice and read and podcast and communicate and go and push and push and push. But one of the things you have, that when you can see and understand things and you can't communicate, you accept that sometimes you come up with the correct answer and everybody else can't get the correct answer. And then by and by, time will happen that people will come up with the correct answer later. And the society or the group will award the understanding to someone else, even though you understood it. It's pointless getting upset about it because there's this obstacle to do it. And so that's another thing brought forward in terms of being able to discover a series of molecules and go things like that. But the understanding, the communication, I haven't had the communication deal and the social skills to say, hey, you know, what about this? Aren't I fantastic? I've sort of just been always moving on to the next struggle. So that's one of the things coming forward. So and with it, what happens is that you start with the sort of understanding of the group and what you understand, what you've been taught, and then gradually you get a new perspective on it because you've been left by yourself. You know, the other people have gone off, basically said, oh, I can't speak to this kid, I'll go off and play separately. So you're left there by yourself on your own devices. So it's the almost perfect environment for incubation of ideas, being left alone. It's not a tearjerker. It's an incredibly insightful thing. So some people will verbalize and speak, because you can't communicate with them, they will verbalize and speak what they're really going to do. They're extremely honest. If they don't think you can understand, if you can't speak, they assume you can't understand them. I don't know. And they'll verbalize, they'll say, well, look, I know, I will play a trick on you. Oh. And then, because you can't communicate to them, and then they come and then they tell a lie. So I'm upset that they told a lie. But it's something you didn't have to really pick up any social cues. So it's, I don't know what it is. So you could see people could be quite duplicitous quite early on, and there is nothing you could do. You can't observe it. So that's the structure coming along. So there's that aspect, that thread coming through. So I was genuinely taught the classical electron. You know, what is the radius? Where is it? How does it go? And I do computer simulations of electron going around a nucleus and just scratch my head. This is on the old TRS-80s, you know, these old things. I'm trying to do Coulomb potentials and try and do it, and I scratch my head. And then I'd say, that's a bit of a letdown. You know, the Bohr postulates, and I draw it along. I held that through high school and through university. Then I did atomic and molecular physics in, third year, I had someone called Dr. Shute. Really lovely person. He and I got on well. But he said, look, there's this thing that the electron can actually go through the nucleus. It can spend some of its time in the nucleus. We know this because of something called the Lamb shift. And I just sort of, you know how you get all these contradictory stuff and you just stack it away for when there's an exam question, you can pull out these contradictory things and produce something which mimics deep understanding and gets you high marks, but you know, just in there. So the electron can go in the way, and then we did scattering, and I was told the proton is a hard sphere, and spherical scattering, of course, just absolutely crazy stuff. That was just because it was an easy thing to do the scattering matrix for. So I really had the full impression of it there. And then I had this really eerie picture. There was this ultraviolet helium lamp, which you hit with really high frequency sparks. So it's only high frequency because it only glowed for a short time after a spark, a few nanoseconds after a spark. So you had to cycle it a few million times a second to get any decent amount of light out of it. That's why it happened. But there was a thing, I can remember the old needle valves, your helium bottles, and you open it up, and there's this general thing way that you can reach the desired level. If you just inch up to the desired level, you take a long time. But if you overshoot and let it undershoot, you're alive. It's the fastest way of doing it. But as you overshoot this lamp, it changes from a pinky, sort of eerie pink to a slightly peachy colour. And then it stops. And I said, what's going on here? What's this peachy colour? And you looked, and I said, look, some sort of background said, I want to understand that. So I had really no idea I had sort of read quantum mechanics. What had happened is that I had a year off overseas before, in year 10, I went off overseas, and I thought, oh, I'm going to do chemistry, oh. And then, so what I did was I went up to the university bookshops for year 11, and I was going overseas, and so I could get a big book, I could only get a small carry book to take overseas, and so there's this very small carry book called Introduction to Quantum Mechanics. It was an introduction, but it was the classical physics introduction to quantum mechanics, the Copenhagen School type of stuff. So we have all these things coming along. And so I said, I really want to understand it. So little by little, I pushed and I began doing equations. And I actually modelled I had a postdoc who had a quantum mechanical wave function calculation thing that he was doing on his computer, involved matrix inversion and stuff like that. And I said, look, can I borrow it? And he said, no. And I thought, I didn't think anything of it. I didn't know that there was professional jealousy and I was being blocked. I thought, oh, well. And a bit of a stroke of luck in terms of my father was Australia's first, the fourth computer in the world, and he was the bright spark 17-year-old. He got his BSc at 17, and was the first computer programmer, the first computer scientist in Australia. And many years later, he died, unfortunately, they said, the evidence is that he was the inventor of computer music. And so we go back. But one of the things he did teach me was how to invert matrices. As a kid, he used to teach me how to do that. So I knew it was this by that, by that, by that, on that, by that. I can still do it there. I can say this by that. I can actually visualize it, but he showed me how to invert matrices, and you needed to do this to run a simulation. So I just went off and wrote the computer program myself, and then I needed more. I needed to be able to calculate the potential curve, and so I went. It was Dave Swan went across to RSPSS, and there's a bit of a story. Sort of a magical story, I won't go into it, about how they started. RSPSS got their first, RS Research School of Chemistry, so RS Chem, it's at ANU. And there's a program called Gaussian, and it said the wave functions that would be used to best for it, and we modeled away and we found the C2 pi U state, C2 pi G state, I think it might be. And I got the curve, and I was able to heroically get the curve and simulate the spectra that I was getting out of it, and write a research paper, second research paper in PhysRev A about it, and draw it along. And I still thought there was a classical electron. And back then they had the big large A2 format. It wouldn't be A4, it was some imperial thing with little holes on the side. All the printouts of all the density plot of where the electron was. And I said, where is the electron? How can it possibly work? And it was actually, it's one of these things which is impossible to work with classical electrons anyway. But I had this thing of where it was, and I looked finer and finer, and the finer I looked, the more smooth it was. It was just smooth three-dimensional thing as you went through the computers, and I realized that the actual wave function was the electron. There was no classical electron. That was a fiction. And I sort of remember that afternoon. It was, I think it was an autumn afternoon, and the sun was coming in, and I said, And the actual sunlight actually went through the trees and landed on the computer paper. And there was this realization, there is no classical electron. What I've learnt is not relevant. It's not correct. And everyone believes it and talks it, yeah, but it's not true. And there is no surface. And sort of back from the childhood, there's this thing, oh, I've realized it, no one else thought. There was a beautiful big shooting star up there. There's no understanding of it. And so it's sort of like I had exactly the right childhood of understanding something and not being able to communicate and go across and being able to carry it and carry the social truth with the actual factual truth to run two truths. And push came to shove. I did a few more papers and I sold a few laser transitions and stuff like that. And my life went a different way. Again, I sort of used my quantum understanding to do stuff with optical fibers. I had a ball with optical fibers, because optical fibers, the actual shape of the light is a quantum wave function. So I just was happy as Larry. And again, I couldn't quite understand band gaps in optical fibers. That took me a couple of months, probably even a year, to fully get what was going on there. So that band gaps of optical fibers led me to understand solid state a bit more. Eventually I grew up and understood it. And you get jobs in industry and not teaching, but then you get into teaching and then you have this enormous feeling that you've understood it, and that's within your own personal world, and you've seen it there. And I sort of have a saying that, well, people have various saying, from the cradle to the grave you're ultimately alone. And so that was an experience. I've almost cherished that experience, to saying, oh look, this is an experience, no one else is having it. And it's sort of not up the front, it's not my first podcast I've done. And so that's the actual experience of it. It's unlikely, or it may help you understand things, it may not, but it's more a communication of what it's like to be someone who's understand. Oh, and can I say then, there's people who say they're quantum physicists, and then they start to describe quantum tunneling, and you realize if an object is very small, it's got a probability of getting through a barrier, and you just go, what? Or they'll say things which are Copenhagen school or not full quantum physics, and they're celebrated quantum physicists and stuff like that, and you say, and it's quantum physics as imagined by the way things are taught at school, and it's all consistent and all lovely story, but the understanding's not there. And you realize, you think, oh, perhaps I should write. No, like I've written to a few people saying, oh, do you know this is an error? Private and confidential, so you don't have to, it's not official or anything like that. You can throw this piece of paper out if you want to, but it'll get to you. So I've written, like, I found a few, a mistake or so in periodic tables or people's literature, and I just write a note because I feel that I should, but you never get a reply for it and you're never going to go anywhere. But there is this beautiful view of quantum physics, and you can see, obviously, if you look at back some of my work where I've described band gaps and stuff like that, it's it's not rocket science, it's not too hard, and it's just, I can't get a Nobel Prize for any of this. I've just read the solid state books, I've just read the quantum physics book, I've just churn through the equations, and look, some of it's hard, but some of it's actually profoundly easy. It's like you couldn't ask for a more break apart equation than the Schrodinger wave equation. And the relativistic stuff is quite fun as well, and the matrix stuff is quite fun. But you can, if you want to separate the time and spatial dependency, it's beautiful. It just breaks into. And then you've got the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which allows you to deal with nucleuses, and it's really good. And when it's wrong, you can just deal with it very quickly with a coupling coefficient to get curves bouncing off each other. There's actually, it's not such a big nightmare to get through. It's a pretty calm and beautiful thing to get through. Yet there are these basic things that we can tell kiddies up the front that about quantum wave functions, quantum wave functions are a consistent narrative. Yeah, a narrative spans from one point to the other and tells the story of existence. And as your life as a whole, the narrative as a whole, any one point is not the sum. The sum of the entire thing is the entire life of that particle. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And the way superposition is actually aligned with the philosophical way. And this is why I don't bully people. I don't. It's not worth slamming in a classical wave, a classical particle point of view, and winning the day, because there's multiple levels. And looking back, in terms of you looking at the threads and narratives which are coming here to the present, and the narratives which will lead, possible narratives which will lead to the future. So that's description of the smallest molecule. I don't know whether I might put a link up to the actual research, some of the research papers for this one. But look, I don't go around the neighbourhood saying, "Hey, I've discovered this," or "I've built that." It's just you against the world. It's you. Like when you're in a laboratory and you're working, you're not competing against anyone. You're not competing against, you are competing against electrical noise. Is one thing you're competing against. Danger is one thing, and the universe is you against. It's not you against the universe. It's you're out there to do your best against the universe, and no competition. It's inside your head. What you learn is what you're going to learn, and then it's locked inside your head, and you'll pop off eventually. And another saying is, from the cradle to the grave, you're ultimately alone. You can understand things, you can share things, you can enjoy it, but can't share them. Well, that doesn't mean you can't enjoy it. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.